Welcome back, everyone. Today we're going to spend a little bit of time examining the Rambam's halachic compendium, his magnum opus, at least from a legal perspective. Some would say his magnum opus, period, end of story. But be that as it may, the Mishneh Torah, one of the great halachic works, really one of the great works overall in our heritage, in our history, after the Mishnah and the Gemara, certainly from a halachic perspective, leaving aside Tanakh, but in terms of rabbinic works, certainly the Mishneh Torah is arms and shoulders, head and shoulders above so many of the other works that we have. And what I want to do a little bit just today for the time that we have is to really just get some sense as to what motivated the Rambam, what led him to write, other than the fact that he was just so bright and so talented and so capable. What in particular compelled him to construct this work? And what I want to use as our primary text is his introduction, which makes good sense. Before we jump in, just a little bit of background to the Mishneh Torah. The Rambam writes this work, according to one of his letters, over the course of approximately a 10-year period. The Rambam clearly doesn't have all day and all night to spend on this. He's working as a doctor as well over the course of these years, and yet at the same time, surely he puts in a significant amount of hours each and every day, and the output, the outcome, both in terms of quantity but especially in terms of quality, is really pretty remarkable, just truly outstanding. So a couple of just basic facts. So what is the structure of Mishneh Torah? So the Rambam opens, as we said, with his introduction, and then there are, as we've noted prior previously as well, there are 14 volumes to the Mishneh Torah, and I've actually going to run through them very quickly. The 14 books are as follows. Just to get a sense, I'll actually throw them onto the board. Give me one second, jot them down to make sure. I've been erasing the Rambam's 13 principles up here, which just feels heretical somehow, but there go the rest of them. So there's nothing symbolic in that other than the need for some space on the board. Here are the 14 volumes, larger sections of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. That's an ayin, sorry. There's Mada, let's see how I do by heart. There's Mada, Ahava, I'll unpack each of these as we go. Zmanin, Nashin, Kiddusha. I'm going to say what that comes next. Is that right? Zero in. Slide over.
Running out of ink.
Yeah, I'm going to switch. Avodah Korbanot. Can you see that? Avodah Korbanot. Missing one. What's here? Okay. Mishpatim. And Shoftim. These are the 14 volumes of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. Let's just make sure we know the subject matter of each. Sefer Mada is really the foundational section of the Mishneh Torah. It includes Mada, the intelligence, the knowledge required that serves as the foundation for our worship of God. We'll have to unpack that as we go along. Ahava is mitzvot that inculcate a love of God. So Hilchot Tefillah appear in Sefer Ahava. The laws of Sefer Torah, Mezuzah, etc. appear there. They're meant to inspire the love of God. It also appears in Sefer Ahava. Tzitzit appears in that section. Hilchot Brachot appears in Sefer Ahava. All these are meant as a collective to inspire that sense of the intensity, that passion. Zmanim are the holidays, so Shabbat and various Yemim Tovim. That's straightforward. Nashim involves various laws of contractual relationships or relationships generally between a man and woman, so the halachot of marriage and divorce, for example, appear in Sefer Nashim. Kiddusha is just three sets of halachot long. In other words, each of these volumes contains a number of subcategories of sets of halachot. So Kiddusha contains only, it's the shortest one, it only has three subsections. It's got Hilchot Isurebia, that's the prohibitions against illicit relations, Hilchot Ma'achalot Asurot, prohibited foods, and Hilchot Shechita, the laws of slaughtering an animal that is permissible in order to actually render it fit for eating. So these are apparently the laws of illicit relations, the arayot, together with the laws of the Jewish dietary laws, are meant to inculcate within us as a people the sense of sanctity of Kedusha. Six is hafla, that has to do with vows that I accept upon myself, commitments. So shivu'ah, a neder, someone accepts nizirut to become a Nazirite. All those appear in that section of Mishneh Torah. Zrayim, this is the same name as the section of Shas, of the Mishnayot. So Zrayim is the law that are incumbent on land. Truma, Maser, Shemitah this year, and so on and so forth. Avodah and Korbanot are closely connected. Both are associated, of course, with the worship in the Beit HaMikdash. Avodah focuses more on what the Kohanim would need to perform in order to offer the sacrifices, and Korbanot focuses a little bit more on the contents, the physical animals that were brought, which animal was brought for which particular korban, organized a little bit more along those lines. Tahara has to do, of course, with Tumah and Tahara, so all the laws that are relevant to that category appear in Sefer Tahara. Nizikin, torts, like we study in first year law school, various laws of damages, physical damages, if I take advantage of another person, all sorts of different kinds of compensation that goes along with that. The halachot of murder, of the chot rotzeach, also appear in Sefer Nizikin. Kinyan, the laws of acquisition, so how do I acquire, how do I give something away, contract laws, all those appointments of messengers, and so on and so forth, all those kinds of laws appear in the 12th book in Sefer Kinyan. Mishpatim, is closely connected to Kinyan, but contract laws and so on and so forth appear in Sefer Mishpatim. And then Sefer Shoftim, judges. I actually have to come back to the content of Sefer Shoftim. Of all these sets of halachot, it's perhaps most surprising to see some things that appear in halachot and Sefer Shoftim. But some of the obvious things include halachot Sanhedrin, which is how the Rambam opens, Hechot Iduk, the laws of testimony. In other words, the laws that, at first glance at least, it would include the laws that govern the functioning of a Sanhedrin or a Beit Din, of a Jewish court of law. So these are the 14 sections of the Mishneh Torah, each one, again, some divided into a variety of halachot. What language is Mishneh Torah written in?
Hebrew.
No, it's written in Hebrew in contradistinction to some of his other works that we've seen. There's no Judeo-Arabic here. This is pure straight Hebrew. We're going to come back. That's going to be extremely important for our discussion as well. So in a word, a very short word, that's a quick bird's eye view from 10,000 or even 20,000 feet as to the content of Mishneh Torah. And the question is, again, why? What leads the Rambam to do this? What I want to do is to jump into his introduction. I'm not going to read the whole thing, although it's not too long. And I gave you Professor Zadortorsky's translation. So we'll read some significant segments. And when we read this, let's try to get a sense as to, Dan, what the Rambam was trying to do, as well as why might this have become somewhat controversial? What might one oppose or find to be offensive about what the Rambam is trying to do here? So the Rambam writes, all the precepts, he opens really, all the precepts which Moses received on Sinai, which were given together with their interpretation, as it is said, and I will give to you the tables of stone and the law and the commandment. Right? So the Rambam starts by offering a foundation for law. And the Rambam says that everything comes ultimately from Moshe at Sinai. Remember, we discussed last week in context of his introduction to the Mishnah, the notion that really everything is rooted back at Sinai, and then dispute is not about the transmission, it's not about Halakha Moshe Sinai. Dispute comes in on the hermeneutical, exegetical side of things in terms of how we understand particular passages in Chumash. But everything essentially, ultimately, harkens back to Har Sinai, right? As it is said, and I will give you tablets of stone, and the law and the commandment. The law in the Pasuk, right? The term, quote unquote, the law refers to the written Torah. That's the word HaTorah, actually, in the Pasuk in Parashat Mishpatim, the commandment, quote-unquote, v'hamitzvah, to its interpretation. Right? So in other words, HaTorah v'hamitzvah, the Torah says in Parashat Mishpatim, that the Jews commit at Sinai to the Torah and the mitzvah. The Torah is the written law, and the, quote-unquote, mitzvah is a reference to Torah Sheba'al Peh. The Rambam goes on to say that all of this is included in the content of the oral of halacha, right, the written law, but also, of course, essential to that is the oral law, which is passed down generation to generation. Now, if you go to the next page, I'm just going to get some highlights. So the Rambam then begins to detail the tradition. This is actually an area that because it's just a reader, Tversky actually skips over this. But there's a relatively long section in the introduction where the Rambam literally goes generation by generation. He says, this generation transmitted to that generation, transmitted to the next one, like the beginning of Pirkei Avot, right? But just much, 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 much longer. In fact, the Rambam details no less than 40 generations from Moshe Rabbeinu all the way till the time of the writing of the Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, of the detailing this transmission. So he writes, although the oral law was not committed to writing, Moses taught the whole of it in his court to the 70 elders, as well as to Elazar, Pinchas, and Joshua, all three of whom received it from Moses. To Joshua, his disciple, our teacher Moses delivered the oral law and charged him concerning it. So too, Joshua, throughout his life, taught orally. Many elders received the oral law from Joshua. Eli received it from the elders and from Pinchas, right? Eli, this is Eli of Shiloh, right? Who was the Kohen in the Mishkan at that time, from the elders and from Pinchas, Shmuel from Eli in his court, David from Shmuel in his court, and so on and so forth. I mean, he's already jumped to David HaMelech, but he goes all the way down to the time of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and the Rambam pauses there. And of all the scholars that the Rambam is interested in, even more than Moshe Rabbeinu for the purposes of this discussion, it's really Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and the writing of the Mishnah. The Rambam spends time on that. He writes, Rabbi Judah, our teacher, the saint, compiled the Mishnah. Really just the fact that he offers this adulatory language for Yehuda Hanasi, or he tips his hand. There was the Rambam really is particularly interested for the purposes of this discussion in Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in particular. Right? From the time of Moshe to that of our teacher, the saint, right? So in other words, from Moshe until Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, right? That no work had been composed from which the oral law was publicly taught. Right? So the Rambam, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's decision to commit the halacha, right? Particularly the halachot of Tevashu Baal Peh, to commit that to writing was a breach in our tradition. No one had done this previously, as we know. When each generation, the head of the then existing court, or the prophet of that time, wrote down for his private use. Yes, there was writing. It wasn't that you weren't allowed to write anything down, but there was just, it wasn't, right? It wasn't a text that was transmitted as the corpus of Jewish law. It was just for quick little reminders, like mnemonics or whatever it may be. Right, private notes, exactly. A memorandum of the traditions which he had heard from his teachers, which he taught orally in public. So to every student wrote down, according to his ability, the exposition of the Torah and its laws as he heard them, as well as the new matter evolved in each generation, which had not been received by tradition, but had been deduced by application of the 13 hermeneutical rules, which we know is very important from the Rambam, had been adopted by the Supreme Court, by the Sanhedrin. This was the method invoked till the time of our teacher, the saint. And then Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi breaks ranks with that. And then skipping one paragraph, asks the Rambam, why did our teacher, the saint, act so, and not leave things as they were? Because, and this is going to be critical for the Rambam, as we'll see, because he observed that the number of disciples was diminishing. Fresh calamities were continually happening. The wicked government was extending its domain and increasing in powers, the reference to the Romans, and Israelites were wandering and emigrating to distant countries. He therefore composed a work to serve as a handbook for all, the contents of which could be rapidly studied and not be forgotten. Throughout his life, he and his colleagues were engaged in giving public instruction in the Mishnah. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi represents this breach in what had previously been not just protocol, but really had been a very firm and crucial law that governed the nature of this transmission. And the Rambam goes out of his way to spend some time explaining, or justifying really, the decision of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi along precisely those lines. Then the Rambam continues with his overview, his quick summary of the history of halacha, and he comes now to, of course, the time not only of the Mishnah, but of the Gemara, and he details all the Amoraic works, some of the outstanding scholars, the Talmud Bavli, the Talmud Yerushalmi. He also mentions the Tosefta, the Sifra, the Sifrei, etc. In other words, the additional rabbinic sources from the time of Chazal that round out the corpus of the Torah Shel-Peh, of the Oral Law, and of course, who is traditionally identified as the one credited with the editorship of the Gemara. Right, really, typically we say it's two scholars, according to tradition. It's Ravina and the one whom Rambam focuses on. right? Ravina and Rav Ashi, and so that's what he summarizes in the section that Rav Ashi and his Beit Din put the finishing touches on the Amoraic elaborations on the Mishnah, and then the Rambam writes at the next bracket. After the court of Rav Ashi, who compiled the Gemara, which was finally completed in the days of his son, an extraordinarily great dispersion of Israel throughout the world took place. Right, so what happens? After the Gemara is completed, then things begin to become particularly difficult, really acute.
Was that from the Muslim takeover of the Persian?
Yeah, quite. Yeah, you would imagine he's referring to early to mid-7th century.
Muhammad, yeah.
And the rise of Islam. You'd think so, that's right. The prevalence of wars, and he doesn't say so specifically, but you'd imagine that that's correct. The prevalence of wars and the march of armies made travel insecure. The study of the Torah declined. Next page, the Jewish people did not flock to the colleges in their thousands and tens of thousands this year before. Remember we talked about earlier on in the year, Surah and Pumbedisa, the great Talmudic academies that then the Gaonim began to occupy. So the Rambam writes that at the time of the Gaonim already this petered out. It wasn't quite what it was at the time of the Gemara. People weren't able to go. And it wasn't any fault of the Gaonim or the people. It was due to historical circumstance. But in each city and country, individuals who felt the divine call gathered together and occupied themselves with the Torah, studied all the works of the sages, and from these learned the method of legal interpretation. And then the Rambam goes on to stress a distinction in authority between, on the one hand, for this reason, the Talmud Bavli, that which was put to writing, set down by the court of Rav Ashi on the one hand, and the authority, the relatively diminished authority of the Gaonim on the other. And if you jump, actually, let's just continue. One second, actually. So give us a section, he skips a little bit. Yeah, let's just continue reading where we are. Remember, he's talking here about the Gaonim, but this is a point of contrast with the authority of the Talmud Bavli, and that's going to be a critical piece. If a court established in any country after the time of the Talmud made decrees and ordinances or introduced customs for those residing in its particular country or for the residents of other countries, its enactments did not obtain the acceptance of all Israel because of the remoteness of the Jewish settlements and the difficulties of travel. So just to pause here for a moment. So in other words, what's the Rambam saying? And there's another piece here which doesn't give us, but I'll just fill in. Rambam is drawing a sharp distinction, a dichotomy between the authority of the sages of the Talmud on the one hand and those of the Gaonim on the other. Now for us, this is pretty straightforward stuff. When we think about the Amorayim versus the Gaonim, right, this is, right, we tend to think of that as a chasm, right, that there's a significant drop-off. I don't mean to say necessarily that they were less intelligent or knowledgeable, etc., but I mean just in terms of authority. But remember, the Rambam, where he's living and when he's living, the Gaonim at that time cast an extremely long shadow. That was the previous generations, the great authorities, the Rif, Rabbeinu Hananel, the scholars to whom the Rambam and the other Sfardim looked up. They themselves were students of the outstanding Gaonim, and Saadia Gaon, and Hai Gaon, and all the other ones that we've reviewed. So for at that time, really, the distinction between the Amoraim and the Gaonim wasn't really so clear. Not only that, remember, where did the Gaonim study? We just mentioned. You know, where were they housed? In the famous yeshivot, Surah and Pumbedisa.
Right.
How did those are the very self-same yeshivot that the Amoraim operated in. They didn't shut down. No one, you know, made a cop on the beam and said, okay, now it's the Talmud is over, that's done, and now we're just a bunch of Gaonim. We're just, right, Gaon means a genius. These were people who were highly respected at the time, who, for them, were continuing the tradition of the Amoraim, unpacking the Gemara further. In fact, certainly through the 7th century, it seems clear that there was some editing that was done to the text of the Bavli. So it wasn't a completely finished text at that time. And so, I thought I had one more.
Okay, we can check.
So the Rambam is coming at a time where the distinction, nice to see you. The Rambam is coming is writing at a time where the distinction between the Gemara, the authority of the Gemara on the one hand, the Gaonim on the other, was not so crystal clear, and yet the Rambam draws this dichotomy. And basically what the Rambam seems to be saying, or says quite clearly, is that the fundamental difference is rooted in the fact that at the end of the day, all Jews, all halachic Jews accepted the authority of the Talmud Bavli in particular, and they simply did not accept the authority of the Gaonim. Huh. It's just they didn't. Why? Any number of reasons. The Rambam focuses here on the vicissitudes, that somehow the Gaonim were less... were able to either comprehend less or to clarify less or just were less successful at becoming the final word just due to historical circumstance because there was so much tumultuousness at that time. So in the end of the day, Rabbi Huda, here's basically the Rambam's overview. Rabbi Huda Hanasi sets halakha to writing. The Talmud then elaborates those crucial writings, that corpus, and becomes authoritative due to the acceptance of Klal Yisrael. That's a very important point. Why do we generally assume, as rabbinic Jews, as it were, that the Talmud is binding? The Rambam's answer to that question is it's actually not up to the rabbis. Interestingly enough, it was up to the community, at least originally. That's how it began. The community accepted those laws as binding. As a result, they became binding. They did not accept the laws of the Gaonim as such for historical circumstance or whatever the reasons were, but that was the bottom line, and therefore there's that distinction. For the Rambam, this is extremely bold because his father and his tradition, again, revered the Gaonim and the rulings of the Gaonim. When the Rambam himself was growing up, the Rambam spoke about the Gaonim in glowing terms. There seems to have been a sort of a weaning off over the course of the Rambam's life. Biographers suggest that the Rambam, as the young, more impressionable, or less fiercely independent Rambam, was a little bit more beholden than old, mature Rambam, who was able to set Mishneh Torah down and say, look, the rulings of the Gaonim are extremely important, they're informative for me. But at the end of the day, if it's my interpretation or the Gaon's interpretation, I'm going to do what I think is right. And the Rambam gains this freedom through this claim that the words of the Gaonim are important, but ultimately not the final word. And so that allows the Rambam freedom to really rule sort of more independently than he otherwise would have, and frankly, than a lot of other halachits were ruling at the time, who expressed much more dependence on the rulings of the Gaonim in this kind of environment. So that's what the Rambam seems to be doing in this section in terms of setting himself up. And the Rambam, if you go to the next bracket on page 39. So now the Rambam, this will sound very familiar. He says, in our days, severe vicissitudes prevail. Right, like the time of the Gaonim, but like another time. What other time did the Rambam refer to as the time of vicissitudes that led us to do something extreme?
During the in Spain when he had to leave.
Right? Right. No, but I mean here, in his introduction proper.
Uh-oh.
What did he describe? What vicissitudes led someone or a group of people to make a radical decision that changed the course of halakha?
When Yehuda Nasi wrote down the Mishnah.
Absolutely, right? And that's what he says. He uses the same terminology. The vicissitudes, the whole nine yards. The Rambam says, you know what? What happens, all right, something along, right, just about 900 some odd years ago, says the Rambam, it's happening again. It's happening to us. Right? In our days, severe vicissitudes prevail, and all feel the pressure of hard times. The wisdom of our wise men has disappeared, as this lament. The understanding of our prudent men is hidden. Hence, the commentaries of the Gaonim, their compilations of laws and responses, which they took care to make clear, right, which were so important to the people who lived just 100, 200 years ago, says the Rambam, have in our times become hard to understand. The works of the Gaonim are no longer helpful in the way that they were a relatively short amount of time ago, at least in the scope of the history of halakha. So that only a few individuals properly comprehend them. Needless to add that such is the case in regards to the Talmud itself, the Babylonian, as well as the Palestinian, the Sifra, the Sifrei, and the Tosefta, all of which works require for their comprehension a broad mind, a wise soul, considerable study, and then one can learn from them the correct practice as to what is forbidden or permitted and the other ground rules of the Torah. And now the Rambam, it's like there's a big trumpet that's blowing. Because everything that the Rambam has written in this introduction is really leading to this. And you see this in sort of the literary gravitas that he brings to bear when he's writing the next paragraph. On these grounds, in other words, because of these vicissitudes, but really all of the foregoing. And so the Rambam writes, I, Moses, the son of Maimon the Svaradi, right? You see, like, right, the trumpets are blaring, right? The ascension of the king on the throne, here it is. Bestirred myself, and relying on the help of God, the mandatory humility, blessed be he, intently studied all these works with the view of putting together the results obtained from them in regard to what is forbidden or permitted, clean or unclean, and the other rules of the Torah, all in plain language, this is crucial, and terse style. Plain language and terse style. Plain language. So first of all, what language does he employ?
Hebrew.
Right, so it's Hebrew. It's plain language, straightforward, and terse style. Right, the Rambam is not an essayist. The Rambam is not writing long-winded, complex. It's just a halakha. Straight. One, two, three, four. Everything crystal clear, tightly organized. So that thus, the entire oral law might become systematically known to all. Without citing difficulties and solutions or differences of view, one person saying so and another something else, but consisting of statements, right? The Rambam does away with what detail or aspect of halakha, I shouldn't say detail, what otherwise central piece of halakha, the notion of debate, notion of machloket. We all know that, right? That in one of our Gemara classes, if you ask the students what the correct answer is, what's the halakha in case X? The right answer is always machloket, right? We all know, right? That's right. 99 out of 100 times that's going to be right. The Rambam says nonsense. Right? Machloket is an accident. Machloket is confusing. Machloket needs to be done away with. The Rambam simplifies the corpus, and he codifies, and he gives us the bottom line, consisting of statements, clear and convincing, and in accordance with the conclusions drawn from all these compilations and commentaries that have appeared from the time of Moses to the present, so that all the rules should be accessible to young and old, whether these appertain to the Pentateuchal precepts or the institutions established by the sages and prophets, so that no other work, should be needed for ascertaining any of the laws of Israel, but that this work might serve as a compendium of the entire oral law, including the ordinances, customs, and decrees instituted from the days of our teacher Moses to the compilation of the Talmud is expounded for us by the Gaonim and all the works composed by them since the completion of the Talmud. Hence, I have entitled this work Mishneh Torah, Repetition of the Law, for the reason that a person who first reads the written law and then this compilation will know from it the whole of the oral law without having occasion to consult any other book between them.
So would you say that the Shulchan Aruch, the preparation of Shulchan Aruch, was a rejection of this concept? That Mishneh Torah is all you would need?
Oh, absolutely. The irony, the great irony, you're absolutely right. The great irony, not just the Shulchan Aruch, but certainly that's among them, and many of the super commentaries that are actually published on the Rambam, right? The irony is that the Rambam sought to complete or to conclude all debate from the ranks of, right, from halachists. And the irony is that there is debate and discussion as to both the intention of the Rambam as well as whether or not the Rambam is convincing, that is published together with his work now. Right, the very way that we print the Rambam with the Kesef Mishnah, the Nagin Mishnah, and this and all the different commentaries, it's itself a repudiation of the Rambam's attempt, which, right, that the Rambam thought he could resolve all Machlok and Kol Yisrael was a little bit too grandiose for that'll be a lesson to us all. Well, right, start with small steps. Don't try to get all of it done in one shot. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, the notion that there's continuing debate revolving around the Rambam is one of the great ironies and testaments to the limitations of what he was truly able to accomplish, 100%. You can imagine that this bestirred some people. Here's the Rambam. I'll give you some examples. Some examples are one judge from Alexandria named Pinchas the Dayan says, I just want to clarify that you don't mean to say that you don't have to learn Talmud anymore. Because in my school, usually we have something called Gemara, Talmud. That's usually what we study. And I was reading your introduction, I was reading your book, and I kind of got the impression that maybe you didn't have to study Talmud anymore. And I just wanted to make 100% sure that that wasn't the case. Of course, the Rambam writes back, and that's how we know. It's in the Rambam's letters. Of course not. God forbid. I never intended such a thing. Meanwhile, in another letter to another student, the Rambam says, really, this is all you need. So, you know, is the Rambam being, you know, a little bit of a politician here? You know, the Rambam's real goal is for this to be accepted. So sometimes he's got to, you know, he's going to talk in different ways to different people. Is that, you know, is that what's going on here? Similarly, if you look at the Rambam's introduction, so even the way that it itself, the introduction is published, Tversky only translates the Rambam. But in our our version of the Rambam in our printing, the Rambam, of course, always comes with the critiques of his dear friends, the Ravid, of Avraham ben David, of Provence, of southern France. So if you take a look, if you take a look at the way that it's printed, and it's very small text here in this particular version, but you'll get the sense. So the Rambam, where are you? Here it is. The Rambam prints his introduction. This is just a note, it's a little small, I apologize. You don't have to read the words. You just get a sense. You just got to see sort of the overview. So here's the Rambam himself, and then over here, printed, overlaid onto the Rambam's introduction, an even smaller text than the small text of the Rambam, is the Hasagot of the Ravid. So the Ravid wrote many famous critiques to the content, to the halachic content of the Mishneh Torah, but he left no stone unturned, and he certainly did not leave the Rambam unspared, and he critiqued the very foundational introduction of the Rambam. He even quibbles left and right on the Rambam's quote, or his summary of our transmission. So Rambam says, well, this rabbi got it from that rabbi. And the rabbi says, well, not so much. And then the Rambam says, well, this rabbi was a great scholar. And the Ravid says, yeah, lo haya velo nivra. That never happened. And so on and so forth. Almost like these gratuitous jabs. In other words, he'd agree with the larger sort of, right, the larger arc of the history, but almost any opportunity to give it to the Rambam, to give him a dig in the introduction, that's exactly right, right? He takes every opportunity. But then toward the very end, and then he comes to the devastating critique of the Rambam, where he really tells you what's truly on his mind. So I'll read you sections from this. So the Ravid writes, Amar Avraham, right? So the Ravid writes, Savar litakin velo tikein. The Rambam thought that he was going to correct matters, but in fact he did no such thing. Ki hu azav derech kol hamechabrim, because the Rambam abandoned the way of all authors, asher hayu lefanav, who preceded him. Ki heim, for they, hevi raya ledivrahim, they always offered proof texts for their position. V'chatu advarim b'shem ha'omram, b'shem omram. Not only did they offer proofs, but they also cited their sources. Right? This is like receiving a paper from a student, right, in a class. There are no sources cited. There is no argumentation. And you just assert that, I don't know, Ernest Hemingway is the greatest author of all time or something, whatever, right? The end, right? And maybe you say that and make it a range of other really interesting assertions, right, that have all sorts of dramatic ramifications in the literary community, if you're part of that community, and then you submit it to critics, so not just to your teacher, but to critics as sort of the final word in your field. Imagine what the response might be. So this is exactly what the response is, right? That's what the Ravid says. He says, now I understand why the Rambam wanted to do this. There was a great value to doing this. So the Ravid is saying here, it would have been really good if the Rambam would have given some sources and some arguments. Because if the Rambam were the greatest scholar to ever have lived and that ever will live, and no one has the ability to ever offer an intelligent opinion ever again, okay, then fine. Then we'll just accept the Rambam as the final word of Jewish law, and we're all going to go home. The Ravid says, yeah, I don't think that's happening anytime soon. Okay, down here in southern France, we've got our own scholars, and we can do just fine on our own. And you're making all these outlandish assertions. Well, I'd like to see what your sources are, what your arguments are, and you know what? The scholars down here will evaluate whether or not that's compelling. If you're not going to tell me where it came from and why you arrived at that conclusion, it's completely unhelpful. It's a waste of my time. Right? This is very interesting because you find this nowadays. You find some rabbinic rulings that are extremely terse and that are published. You have these should internet, where you have these responsa, extremely brief responsa that are published online. Rav Aviner in Israel does this because he receives hundreds upon hundreds of text message questions literally a day. He'll receive 100 questions a day, if I understand correctly. And when you receive 100 text message questions and you're a busy rabbi with other things to do, what kinds of answers do you give?
Terse.
Right? Between one word and six words, let's say, on average. Now let's say you want to publish those. Right? And they include halakhic questions, but also philosophical issues. Right? Like, you know, is the Messiah... Is this the Messianic era? And then he'll answer something like, it's up to us, or something like that. No, what do you do with that? Like, what does that mean? Or in all likelihood. Like, what are you...
Begging the question.
What?
It's begging a question.
Right, that's pretty good. So that's kind of the critique of the Ravid here. And then he concludes, he says, you know, the Rambam sometimes just said, this is what the Gaonim say, right? But the problem is, sometimes the Gaonim, who are extremely influential again at this time, sometimes they disagreed with one another. It wasn't like one Gaon, it was like Tosfot. There was a whole, right, there a range of them that exist, they lived over the course, and wrote prolifically over the course of hundreds of years. Right, so don't just tell me, oh, this is what, because that's what the Gaonim said. Uh-huh. What happens when they disagree? Tell me, this one says this, this one says that, this is what I think, and this way other scholars can evaluate for themselves. Right, so this is the great critique of the Rambam, and then he concludes, right, his closing salvo, in ze ela kol, and he quotes a pasuk, I think it's from Daniel, kavel di ruach yetera bay, which is roughly translated as someone with extra spirit invested in him, which, with regard to which, he doesn't mean that the Rambam is a person of great spirit, but he means that the Rambam is full of hot air. So that's the Ravid's, literally. They make it up, and this is not dissimilar to some of the language that the Ravid uses in some other sections. There's a whole other conversation about rabbinic dialogue and how you have different sort of textures or tones, overtones to rabbinic dialogue, and certainly that between the Rambam and the Ravid, if feisty and entertaining, was not always pleasant and friendly at all times. Which doesn't mean that there wasn't a tremendous amount of reverence, but it meant that the entire system felt like it was under attack. And he felt like this is a systematic dissembling of everything that we had learned and invested in and built as a system of halakha, and this is the kind of pushback that you get.
I have two questions. First of all, did each of them earnestly and sincerely think that they were doing this for the Shem Shemayim, if
absolutely
they were disagreeing with
absolutely
each other? And the second, well, that's why I assumed that, but I wanted to hear it for sure. And the second question is, did Rambam defend himself when he came under attack like this? In other words, how did he deal with this attack, an hominem attack, essentially?
Right. So I don't know if he saw this particular critique, but the Rambam did see a range of critiques that came to him in Baghdad, which was the seat of the Gaonet. There was a lot of fury about it. And remember, that was a community that was already dwindling in its influence, in its numbers, and so this seemed like the final straw. So there was a lot of pushback. So we have letters from there. We have letters I mentioned from Pinchas, the judge in Alexandria. And then you have more positive letters from the scholars of Lunel, also in southern France, in the same general area as the Ravid is writing as well. The Rambam, we have approximately four or so letters that have been saved for posterity that in which the Rambam defends himself. And then there are some other writings in which he refers to his intentions in Mishneh Torah and defends it as well. This is his defense, though, and most of what he writes in his letters is consistent. The Rambam basically is saying, I felt that I had no choice. The very future, the very existence, right, of our rabbinic law is under threat. Right. Remember, the Rambam is receiving these incredibly troubling letters about all sorts of tumult taking place throughout the Jewish communities all over the globe. Not only locally for his community, which is just poverty-stricken. Remember, the Rambam spends half his life fleeing from place to place after the Almohad invasion. He gets these letters from Yemen with these false messiahs that are telling people to convert away from Judaism to Islam. And the Rambam has to give them strength. He's receiving reports of just a sense of upheaval that he thinks does not exist. Now, he doesn't know that we're going to see a lot more of this, unfortunately, from many hundreds of years to come. But for him, this could be the beginning of the end. So his defense is essentially, I felt that, A, that I felt I had no choice, and B, that he sort of presents himself as more modest than might have otherwise been understood. I don't need to supplant, I need to complement, and so on and so forth. Now, the other thing the Rambam is trying to do, clearly, is to anchor himself in tradition, and particularly the tradition of the Mishnah. The Rambam is not just, but it's not just a coincidence that the Rambam gives you the entirety of the tradition, and he's claiming, I am the next link in that chain. Clearly, he's establishing his own authority by establishing the authority of those who preceded him, but in particular, he's taking the mantle of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Remember, what was the language of the Mishnah?
Hebrew.
Pure, simple Hebrew. Terse, to the point, clear, in a way. It's not always so easy to understand the Mishnayot. But clear language, succinct, to the point, and so on and so forth. In fact, so much to the point that one of those letters that the Rambam received, one of the questions is, wait a second, if you're building off the model of the Mishnah, there's one key distinction. There's one crucial problem for you, Rambam. What does Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi include? Does he include only the final opinion? The majority opinion? Right? Debate appears all over in the Mishnayot. Rabbi Shimon says this, Rabbi Yehuda says this. Right? Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, and so on and so forth. The Chachamim, right? All the different opinions. So if the Rambam is really modeling himself after Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he's asked in one of these letters, why don't you include debate? And the Rambam's answer actually is that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi only included debate where he himself was not sure as to what the final answer really was. But now that we lived after the time of the Gemara and the Gaonim, in which we've resolved so many of these questions, there's no longer that need to include debate. I mean, you can see that Rambam is recasting, reinterpreting. It's not implausible. I don't think it's the simple explanation of what's happening in the Mishnah. But most don't. But it's a reasonable sort of a way of seeing things. But the Rambam basically, again, not, you know, some would say he was an autocrat. And some would say he was a power grab. Right? The Rambam would say, right, this is just what I need to do for the sake of continuity of tradition. I've been given no choice, and if you have a problem with me, go ask Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi the same kinds of questions. Because he rewrote the entire tradition, and redid everything, because he felt that he had no choice. So this is really very much the project of the Rambam in Mishneh Torah. What we still have to look at a little bit is some of the aspects of the structure, which is fascinating. Give a whole series of shiurim on the structure of Mishneh Torah. It's ingenious. And the Rambam thought through everything. Nothing was left to chance. He thought through what these 14 categories would be, what their names would be, which halachot would be included in which one, where he would put each. Just to give you a sense, also, the Rambam clearly is not just writing a halachic work, because Sefer Mandas starts with Yesod HaYesodo, Ba'amud HaAmudim. It starts with a teleological, Aristotelian proof for the existence of God on the basis of the first cause argument. And then there's a lot of substantial amount of theology, in particular in Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah. And Sefer Madah, he has Hilchot Avodah, he has Hilchot Deot, which are proper intelligence and character traits. He then has Hilchot Avodah Zarah and Talmud Torah, and Hilchot Shuvah. These are foundational principles for the philosophy and the core living of what it means to be a Jew. He then gives you all these areas, right? Ahava also is foundational in the sense that, and he listed early on, we've mentioned love of God, awe of God, right? Ahava and Yirah are mitzvot 3 and 4 of the Rambam's positive commandments, we noted last week, right? Out of the 248. So clearly Ahava, and he includes Morah, although it's interesting he calls it Ahava, and the notion that nature and that Torah study and that study of metaphysics can lead one to a love of God, as well as all these mitzvot that I mentioned earlier that are meant to be reminders. So it's mezuzah, and it's brachot, and so on and so forth. And then at the end, Sefer Shoftim, although it seems to just be to concern jurisprudence, so it's just the functionings of the Beit Din, etc., Sefer Shoftim actually concludes with Hilchot Melachim, the laws of kings, and the last two chapters in all of Mishneh Torah and Sefer Shoftim actually concern the coming of the Messiah. Right? So, which is a pretty interesting study. So the Rambam begins with theology and ends with eschatology. And so clearly the Rambam is arguing, what he's trying to say is, sometimes we think of halakha as sort of unanchored in and divorced from our fundamentals of faith and lived experience, and the Rambam brackets Mishneh Torah to polemicize against that view and to embrace just the opposite. And so we need one cohesive, coherent, theological and halachic work that really pulls everything together, as well as the experiential dimension, especially in Sefer Ahava, so it pulls all that together in this way. So next I'm going to have to look a little bit at the structure of Mishneh Torah, and then we'll be in position to move to his Guide to the Perplexed. Thank you.